Well, last night, President Donald Trump in a State of the Union address said that he will meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un on February 27th and 28th in Vietnam. To help us preview what might come out of that summit is Eli Lake. He is a Bloomberg opinion columnist. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Eli, thank you for joining us. What do you expect will come out of this summit between the U.S. and North Korea in February?
I think there's a very good chance you will see a statement, a kind of declaration of peace, which is similar to statements that have been made before, but would pave the way to a formal peace treaty that ends the Korean conflict. Today, there's only an armistice. And I think you may see a new policy where you would see the relaxation of sanctions on North Korea in exchange for some progress on what's called denuclearization or disarmament, but not the old policy, which is that no sanctions would be lifted until there was verifiable disarmament from North Korea.
So, Eli, are we any closer to denuclearizing North Korea?
Well, especially I don't think we are, especially if a recent report from the UN Security Council is correct that says that, you know, that the North Koreans have not only continued their development of weapons programs, but are continuing to sell it to other rogue actors. And, you know, the leaders of the U.S. intelligence community also said that they do not expect that Kim Jong-un would ever verifiably give up his nuclear arsenal completely. And this follows a pattern. We know that dictators develop nuclear weapons in a way as a kind of insurance policy, because if you have a credible threat to incinerate a city like Seoul or other neighboring cities, then you will not be invaded like someone like Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi.
So, Eli, who has the leverage here, the U.S. versus North China? North Korea? It just doesn't seem like anything has materially changed over the years. And I'm just wondering, other than the fact that the president is meeting with Kim Jong-un, which is historic in and of itself, what's changed?
Well, the Trump administration, the president himself, would say that the young leader of North Korea wants to bring economic prosperity to his country, and that this is a source of leverage because the United States is a wealthy country and it can help with that. But that defies, in a lot of ways, everything we know about Kim Jong-un. Remember, you know, Kim Jong-un murdered his uncle and had, I think, his half-brother murdered and has done terrible things in terms of his climb to power and has acted in a ruthless manner that suggests that if he really is interested in the kinds of things he needs to do for prosperity, that would mean opening up his society and opening up his economy in a way that would be ultimately a threat to him. So I don't think that I don't believe the happy talk that he's interested in this sort of economic development. But the answer that I think the White House would give you is that, you know, the U.S. can provide North Korea with the means to get their country out of, you know, extreme poverty.
I want to shift gears a little bit beyond North Korea, because when we talk about national security, I have to wonder what's going on with Venezuela and how much is this becoming a sort of solidification of an alliance between China and Russia versus the United States and other developed markets?
Well, that's a very good question. And certainly Venezuela is a country where you've seen both Russia and China play the role of sort of the big power and development. But, you know, China last year began to call back its loans from Venezuela at a moment when, you know, its economy was cratering as it is now. And its oil sector has been so depleted because of its mismanagement and the corruption of the Chavez and Maduro regime. And in many ways, the Chinese might be looking at their initial investments in the earlier part of this decade into Venezuela as a pretty bad bet. I think that the Russians have a different kind of interest because they see that Venezuela could potentially play the role that Cuba played in the Cold War, which is a source for power projection in the hemisphere. So, you know, I think their interests align here. I know that the U.S. intelligence community leaders last week said that they feared a kind of Russo-Sino alliance against, you know, the rest of the sort of more Western democracies. But I still think that there are a lot of sort of sources of tension there, and it could very well be a classic mistake that the U.S. intelligence community, many in the U.S. intelligence community, made in the Cold War, where they believed that, you know, two countries that followed the same communist ideology would be natural allies, when in fact, you know, there are rivalries between them that border has never really been quite so quiet. So in a lot of ways, I would say that, you know, we still have to sort of wait and see, but there is a different point, which is also worth making, which is that we see it all the time, that autocrats and autocratic regimes will band together when there is a democratic threat to those regimes. So it's in the interest that of China and Russia to see that the democratic tumult that we're seeing now in Venezuela fails, because that kind of same thing can be a threat to them at some point.
Wait,
later
hold
on
one second. Are you saying that right now China is very much an autocratic country, and that its alliances are going to be with other autocrats, period, the end?
Well, China is an autocratic country, and its alliances are, you know, largely with other autocratic countries. And we see we see it with Russia, for example, protecting Bashar al-Assad in the UN Security Council. And I think you'll see more and more with China the same kind of behavior. I mean, I think that.
So, Eli, what do you think are the next steps in Venezuela? It's been kind of calm since Guaido assumed his position as, I guess, president number two or president number one. What do you think are next steps?
Well, we're seeing more and more pressure. I mean, most of Europe has now come out and recognized Guaido as the interim president. I think that there will be more and more pressure now through humanitarian aid that, you know, will be delivered. And we'll see. The real question here is, if Maduro gives an order not to accept or to block humanitarian aid to his starving population, will the military follow that order? If Maduro gives an order, which, by the way, apparently he didn't over the weekend in the face of mass demonstrations, for his military to fire into the crowds, will the military follow that order? That's really where the rubber hits the road. And I think that there is an understanding that, you know, he can have his generals, as he did last week, show up in a press conference saying that they're still loyal to him. But if the order is given, how many of the middle and lower ranking members of the Venezuelan military will follow it? They are suffering the same kind of privations as the rest of ordinary Venezuelans. And so in that respect, I do think that Maduro's days are numbered.
Just real quick, in one word, which is a bigger threat, North Korea or Venezuela?
Well, North Korea is a bigger threat because they have nuclear weapons. Sorry, North Korea.
Eli Lake, thank you so much for being with us. Eli Lake, we always love reading your columns for Bloomberg Opinion, coming to us from Washington, D.C. Read his columns. They are fabulous. He covers national security.